Accession number 24189, Reel 2.
Mr. Carter, Reel 2. We're talking about your training as a telegraphist at HMS Scotia from July till the end of September 1943. We're talking about how you learnt the Morse code, and they tested you, and if you failed, you were backclassed. How did you do at it? I mean, did you find it came natural, or did you find it hard going?
No, I found it quite fairly easy. After the 8 weeks, they still increased it one word a minute until you reach 15 weeks. And when you reach 15 weeks, you have another test. If you fail the 15 weeks test, you're out. That's it, you're out. Now, the hardest part is going from 15 weeks onwards, because at 15 weeks, you're doing 15 words a minute. But you reach what they call a plateau stage. You get stuck. And you can't go faster. It's just, you reach that stage where you can't go any faster. It seems as if you're stuck there for a while, and then suddenly it falls into place and you can move on. And you move on, and then you pass out at 22 words a minute. And that is the fastest speed of any of the forces. I think the Air Force was about 18 words a minute. The Army was about 20 words a minute. And the Navy was 22 words a minute.
How would they actually train? Were you in a room with someone at the front transmitting
to
you?
Yes, and you all had headphones on. Yeah.
And, I mean, some really experienced naval operators would go even faster, wouldn't
they? Yes.
I'll just check. Yeah, yeah. They could go up to you tell me.
Well, what governs the speed of Morse, especially receiving Morse, is how fast. Because it was in those days, it was all with a pencil and paper, and it wasn't typewriters or anything like that. Like now, if you think about it, you're taking down a message. And you're writing at 22 words a minute. Five letters. That's 110 letters you're writing in a minute. Now, you take, for instance, an E. An E is dot. It's the shortest, it's the hardest word to, hardest letter to write, but it's the shortest Morse. You see? And so if you've got a word with several E's in, you know, I mean, you really had to go some. So you were limited to how fast you could write. I could write at a maximum 25 words a minute. And when I was on the Goodall, if anybody... I was a T.O. Sparker, T.O.
Telegraphist. I've led you slightly on, that's my fault. I'll hold that bit for a bit.
Okay.
Now, some people have said that it's almost like music, that it becomes almost instinctive,
well,
picking it up when you're hearing.
The point is this. When you first hear it, it goes in there, you think about it, and then it comes out there.
From your hand, when you're writing
it. When you're used to it, it goes in there and it comes out there. It bypasses your brain. It's so fast that as you hear it, you write it. You don't have to think dot dash, oh, that's A. I mean, it's dot dash there and it's there.
And the other thing is, they also say, it might be better left to later, but they also said that a really good operator could recognise somebody's fist. Or keying method. Is that true, would you say?
Well, I don't know, because I don't think we would get enough of a single operator to be able to tell that.
That's fair enough. So, the Morse code, you had this plateau and then you overcame. Now, you weren't back classed then?
No.
Right through and then got through the 15 and everything to the end?
Got through to the end, and then at the end... Because they were so short of signal people, communications, as they called us, communication ratings, They brought in a system, a fast track system, where if you passed high enough, you could pass out at a higher rate. So if you pass out at, say, 95%, they would make you a telegraphist. Although you were an ordinary, it starts off ordinary telegraphist, trained operator, leading telegraphist. That's how the rank goes. And you should normally pass out of training as an ordinary telegraphist. But if you pass out with high enough marks, you could be made a telegraphist or a trained operator. 95 for a telegraphist and 98% for a trained operator. But you wouldn't be paid for that until you had passed a period, 3-month period, when you would be assessed. So if you went on board to a ship, you would go on as an ordinary telegraphist, although you had been passed as a telegraphist. And when you'd been on there 3 months, you would go up before the captain and he would get reports on you and then say, yes, right, you're rated telegraphist, and then we'll start paying you.
Now, one of the things we we're talking about, that, you know, the telegraphist training. Mm. They've got the Morse code. What else were they teaching you at
coding?
What's coding?
Well, all the different codes and ciphers that are used for coding and ciphering messages.
Now, what did you have to learn, and what types were in use? This may be a bit complicated to remember, but...
Well, I can remember, because you had naval code, you had fleet code, you had psycho. I think they were the three. Oh, and CCM.
Now, I'm sorry to be a pain, but what were these? So, naval code, what was that?
Well, a naval code was a 5-figure group that represented a word or some words, like a phrase. And what you did, if you had a message to code, when you're trained, you know within a little whether you can have... we say proceed to. You wouldn't code proceed as one group and to as another group, because you know there was a group that said proceed to, because it was a standard thing, you see. And so you had to learn how to code a message, you know, how to break it down into parts to be coded. And you had, in effect, like a dictionary, and you would look up a word, and that would give you a 5-figure code, and you would write that 5-figure code down for that word, and then you'd go through the message like that, you see. But, as I say, some words you could string several together, and one 5-figure group would cover those words.
And I presume some wouldn't be in the dictionary, would they?
Or? No. Then they would have to be spelt out, you see, letter by letter.
Still in 5-figure groups?
Yeah, right? Still in 5-figure groups, yeah.
Now, that's naval code. What about fleet code?
Well, when you're talking about codes, if you code a message, you have to know how long you want that message to be secure. And so that... And by knowing how long each code takes to be broken, you would know whether... You could use one code or another code. You see, when they use this 5-figure code, they also used to recode the 5-figure code. So it gave it more security, you see. Now, a fleet code was a 3-letter code, not 5 figures, 3-letter code. And that was a similar code, but it just hadn't got the same amount of security. Then you had...
So that would be for less important messages.
That's right, yeah. Or a message where you had to decode it quickly.
So sometimes it would be more important.
Yeah, because, you know, it's no good you sending a message to say that there's a battleship on the horizon if it's going to take 2 hours to decode the signal telling you that, you see.
So that's fleet. Now, psycho.
Well, psycho... was a code where you've got letters and figures mixed. That was another one. And then another one was a self-evident code. Now, a self-evident code was you would, if you saw a battleship on the horizon, you'd send one BB, one battleship. Course, distance, speed. And that would be a self-evident code.
So, and, well, and when would you use the Psycho one? Until you'd use the last one. The last one you'd use when it was really urgent. But
well, I can't really remember how we came to use that one.
And CCM?
CCM was where you typed in a message. And it was, you know, the German Enigma, similar to that. Similar to the
was
German
that
Enigma.
In use in the Second World War, though?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was an American. And the British equivalent was Type X. That, and those, they were machine codes.
So you were learning all these. That sounds like a lot to learn.
Well, it was a lot to learn. And then you also had to learn procedure.
Now, tell us about procedure. What wireless procedure is it?
Wireless procedure.
What about wireless procedure? What was it? And, you know...
Well, you had to know how to call up somebody to send a message, how to finish off a message.
So how did you... Sorry, I know. How did you do it? How did you call someone up? How did you... You might not remember now. I know. It's a long time ago. But what you can remember of wireless procedure...
You just used to call somebody... you never used the ship's name. They all had call signs. And you called up the call sign, V, your call sign. And then you'd say that you got a message for them. Well, there were all sorts of signals, Q signals they called them, that would tell people... Can you hear me? What strength can you hear me? QSA, and they would send back Q. You would send interrogative INT QSA, and they would send back QSA 5, which was the highest reception you could get. So all these things you have to learn. You see, you have to learn all the Q signals. Repeat is IMI. Did it, da da, did it.
It was all, by the way, key. You didn't have
key. We did have voice as well. Yeah.
Well, perhaps come back to that later. Yeah. So, what about the voice? Well, no, let's do voice now. What about the voice?
Similar sort of thing. You've got to learn the procedure. And they used voice mainly in convoy to converse between ships, because it was a lot easier and a lot quicker than using a Morse key. You could just but it was the same, one call sign to another call sign, and then you would just
what was that system of wireless call, the thing, telephony or what
wireless telephony.
Wireless telephony. Was that easier to use generally?
Well, yes. Because usually with RT, radio telephony, it wasn't heavily coded stuff. It was mainly, you would call up, if you saw a torpedo approaching, you'd call up and say, toasty starboard or something like that, which a toasty was a torpedo, and it was that sort of thing, you see. So, and that was used in between the ships in the convoy. But the wireless telephony part was used mainly to receive messages from the Admiralty, because these were going on 24 hours a day. They were being, somebody was on watch 24 hours a day listening to Admiralty messages.
I'll come to that, because that's more when we're on the ship. It'd probably be easier for you to tell. So you learned how to use radio telephony as well. What about... the wirelesses, the radios, and how they operated, you know, the inside.
Oh, you had to learn that as well, yeah.
I mean, what level did...
You didn't learn much about the actual operating of the wireless set until you got on board ship. Very little practical wireless receiving. It was all classroom stuff, mainly.
But what I mean is, when the wireless broke, would you know how to fix it?
No. that's a radio mix job.
So you wouldn't really under, you know...
No.
That was... Anything else you were taught? And there's an awful lot you've told us, but anything else you were learning at AIR?
Not I can think of, no. I think that was just wireless telegraphy. Procedure and coding, they were the main, that was what they had to drum into you.
Now you were there till the end of September, I think, learning, and that's what you were doing.
That's right, yeah, and then I went to Valkyrie on the Isle of Man.
Was there a sort of examination before you left there, or
before,
of everything?
Before we left Scotia.
Yeah.
Well, I think the 15 weeks came into that.
If
I remember rightly, yeah.
Now, you HMS Valkyrie, that's the Douglas, Isle of Man.
That's right, yeah.
Another shore station.
That's right. Yeah.
And you got there on the 1st of October, right, yep, at the start of October, 43, and you were there for about until the back end of January, 44.
That's right.
Now, what was the setup there at Valkyrie? Can you describe? Cause
well, they were hotels on the seafront that were taken over by the Navy, so that they could be trained, they could be turned into a signal school, you see. And we just, a couple of the hotels were just accommodation. One hotel was the wireless training hotel. And you just went along there for classes, the same as you
did. What were the hotels like? I mean, did you have proper beds and things in them? No.
Bunk beds. Mm.
So it was comfortable enough.
Oh yes, yes.
And what? How did your training progress there, or was it just more of the same?
More of the same. I mean, higher standard, obviously, because you were going faster, and that's where you did your final passing out. I passed out as a telegraphist.
So nothing new there. Any exercises or sea exercises or anything like
no,
that?
No.
So, as passing out as a telegraphist, you've done pretty well, because that's one up from where you...
that's right, yes.
And anything else happened while you were at Douglas? Because you were there 3 months.
No, it was just virtually just training. There's nothing much to say about that. The hotel's just along from us. Well, they housed Italian and German prisoners of war. So many hotels were taken over as prisoner of war camps on the Isle of Man.
So what was the next stage then? January 44?
January 44, I went to HMS Pembroke at Chatham.
That's
barracks.
The barracks, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, barracks at Chatham. And from there, I was sent to join...
Now, anything happened at Pembroke Barracks that you recall, or was it just a...
No, it was just to go there to be sent somewhere else.
Did it take long, or...
Well, I was there. I joined at Pembroke on the 28th of the 1st, 44. And I joined HMS Goodall on the 28th of the 2nd, 44.
So
I wasn't there
just
very long. And I joined HMS Goodall in Bangor Bay, Northern Ireland.
Where is Bangor Bay? Is that...
Northern Ireland.
No, I mean, whereabouts? Is that... That's not near Belfast, is it? Or is it?
Not too far from Belfast.
Oh, it is that right? What were your first impressions of the Goodall? Because they were unusual ships. There's no two ways about it. For the Royal Navy, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
You joined her on the 28th of February 1944.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So, what did you think of her?
Well, I was a bit. A bit frightening, really, because I've never been on a ship before, there's a lot to learn. And I wasn't too happy. It seemed very cramped. There seemed to be far too many men and not enough room. And sleeping, the mess deck was small and it was cramped, and when you first went on board there, you slept in a hammock. You see, when these ships were built, they were equipped with bunks, but there weren't enough bunks for the number of people that the British Navy wanted to pump onto these ships. So obviously they had to weld hooks onto the bulkheads, and so that you could sling your hammock there, you see. So we were sleeping on hammocks. We were sleeping on hammocks. When you first went there, you got a hammock. There were people sleeping under the hammocks on lockers. There were people sleeping on the deck. And there were people sleeping in bunks. And as you became more senior, so you graduated and finished up in a bunk.
What were the mess decks like, to be on? I mean, it gives an idea of what you could see as you in your hammock, perhaps. How big were they?
Not very big. Not very big at all. In our mess, there are 18 people in our
mess. Now, were you the communications mess?
Yeah.
Whereabouts on the ship was that? Can you remember?
It was below the superstructure, below the bridge and the chart house, the wireless office, and below that, up at the fore part of the ship. Not right forward, but towards the fore part of the ship.
So that you were near your action stations and near the bridge?
Straight up to the wireless office, yeah.
And what about there were meant to be quite a few American design features, you know, that like laundry and...
Well, there was a laundry, but although there was a laundry, lots of people still did their own laundry. We did buckets of water.
And now, why did you...
Well, I can't really remember whether it was more convenient or whether it was a charge, I'm not sure. I can't really remember. But it just became more convenient to do your own laundry.
So how did you do it?
Just washed it in a bucket.
And where would you dry it?
In the funnel space. It was quite warm in there.
Now, you joined her at the back end of February 44.
Yeah.
Where was she based at that time? Was she based at Belfast? Or
yes, yes.
And what was the sort of daily routine that you settled into for you? You know, as a telegraphist or acting telegraphist.
Well, I was classed as an ordinary telegraphist for duties, and it's just a matter of doing four hour shifts, 4 hours on, 4 hours off. And listening to messages and taking
Did they go in? Were they the same as the watches?
Yeah. And they were 4 hour watches, and the dog watches were 2 hour watches, which meant that you didn't get the same watch every day. It took 3 days to do the complete circuit.
And what was the room like? You at the wireless room.
Oh, it was quite
Where good. Exactly was it? Under the bridge, was it?
Under the bridge, under the chart house. There's a bridge, chart house, wireless office.
And what was in there?
There was a little room with a coding, a CCM machine, coding machine. That was a little tiny cubby hole. There were a bank of wireless sets, two very large transmitters about the size of a single wardrobe, and a very small transmitter, TBS transmitter receiver, which was for interconvoy RT. That's about all there was in there, actually.
And what would your typical shift be like? How many would there be on duty at a time?
Well, there'd be one telegraphist, or telegraphist TO in my case, and one coder. Now, the reason we learnt coding while we were in training, although there were coders, was the fact that on small ships, they didn't have a coder. The telegraphist did the coding, you see. So it was just that on the good old and ships of that size, they had a coder in each watch. And as I say, you just read messages. You just sat tuned into one. The ordinary telegraphist sat tuned into one wavelength and would be listening to the Admiralty messages the whole time. He would be taking them down. They would read the headings to see if the messages apply to that particular ship. And if they didn't, then they didn't do anything with them. But if they apply to that ship, they would be decoded and passed to the officers.
And how frequent were messages? I mean, was it going on all the time?
All the time, yeah. Yeah.
Could you keep your concentration across 4 hours? I mean, it's a long time.
Well, it is, yeah. And while I was in Western Approaches, a signal came from the C&C Western Approaches that said no communication ratings should be kept on in two watches. That means four on, four off. No communication rating should be kept on four on, four off in two watches for longer than 24 hours because their efficiency deteriorated 50%. So that means a half of every message would be wrong.
So you just sit there, basically?
Just sit there, headphones on, a bank of half a dozen pencils in case they broke while you were writing, so you could just...
And you'd be taking down fairly meaningless...
Yeah, five figurehuckles mainly.
Which didn't mean much to you.
No.
And then you'd pass some
that's right.
to the coder.
You take the headings down, and then the rest of it would be five figure codes. And the headings would tell the coder whether they were anything to do with us or not.
So you didn't really know what you were taking down?
No.
How accurate were you, would you say?
Well, I would say I was very accurate.
But is that 100% or is that 98 or 80? I mean, do you know what I mean?
I would say, unless there was some adverse weather conditions, I would be 100%.
And even at the end of a shift?
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, you'd just be doing this for the full 4 hours?
Yes.
What about a coffee break or tea, but more likely than a tea break? I mean, was that possible?
Well, you got, if he was on the middle, on the night watches... They would, the coder would probably go down and get a mug of cocoa for the watch. He would get a mug of cocoa each, about halfway through the watch. He would go down to the galley and they would serve cocoa. But during the daytime, I don't think we ever had any refreshments.